Mr. Chairman.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, May 5th, 2015. First item on the agenda is a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 173. Senator Boquist, please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 173 comes to us from Senator Boquist. The bill authorizes a person who is licensed with a concealed carry permit to present a valid concealed carry license to a peace officer in lieu of presenting a firearm for inspection. This bill was voted out of the Senate committee unanimously with one member excused and passed unanimously from the Senate floor with two members excused.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good members of the committee. One of my constituents brought this, you know, common sense. Actually, I had two common sense ideas come forward. I am representative, state representative, not Senator Brian Boquist. I represent the Senate District 12, which is your 23rd and 24th House districts, and my neighbor across the way is their representative Post on one side, and I don't think any of, and Representative Olson on the other side. This particular bill, like I said, was brought forward as a common sense piece of legislation. If you don't know, and I think maybe one of you wasn't here, when we started having large gun hearings in this building a few years ago, for some unknown reason, instead of talking to legislators and people who knew what was going on, there was this sudden move, we're going to post signs and have everybody hang their concealed weapons permit on the outside and carry their gun all exposed. And of course, you all know what the kind of the press looked like in this, so on and so forth. And buried in that same piece of law is this little section that says a public safety officer, police officer, as several of you are, you know, can inspect your weapon. And of course, the first thing that caught it out is how many times is an accidental discharge the thing you don't want to happen in a public building? Now, I could do a demonstration for you because I am a concealed weapons carrier, but the idea of this bill is pretty simple. You're approached by a police officer and you present your concealed weapons permit. Instead of dragging out the firearm that is loaded in the middle of a public building and inspecting it, clearing it, and potentially having an accidental discharge, it would be a better idea just to validate that the concealed weapons permit was there and that the individual had gone through the training that most of us voted on previously, except for a few of you that weren't here, and let that be the process. It would probably save future hysteria in public buildings like the state capitol, and it was also prevent an accidental discharge. Amazingly enough, this is not the first time the bill has ever come up or the second time the bill has ever up, but is the first time it's ever passed across the Senate floor. And I would point out to at least the law enforcement members here and the common sense members, which I'll mean is all of you, that it's a pretty good idea that we do this instead of having people drag their firearm out in the middle of public, create hysteria, and maybe have an accidental discharge. And I'd be open to any questions that you could possibly give to me that pertain only to this bill.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Williamson should carry the bill.
Any questions for the senator? Thank you.
Thank you.
Johnston.
My given name is Ed Johnston. I'm here in frustration. We have a Second Amendment right, not a privilege. I carry open and concealed, and I've been doing it almost all my life. I've been doing it in my county for more than 20 years. Most of you know it. It's been in the papers. I don't need to ask permission for a concealed license permit from my employees, my servants. Okay? If you read the Constitution, in our structure, especially the Oregon State Constitution, all right, when you pass these administrative bills, it only affects you, the elected and public servants, and church members. It does not affect we the people.
So today what we're talking about...
I know, I'm going to be putting evidence in...
We're not going to waste a lot of time.
I'm not wasting time, I'm putting it on record.
Showing that if you have a concealed permit and you're in a public building, an officer wants to see it, you just need to show the permit.
I'm going to be getting to that point with the respect, because this is where it comes down to common courtesy, what most of us have forgotten, and most of us have forgotten to teach responsibility, not only to ourselves, but our children in a lot of this. Because if it comes to an accidental discharge, everybody goes, what if? But what happens when if never happens? Do we teach paranoia? No, we're supposed to teach responsibility. And when it comes down to common sense, with that, when you go into a public building, but when I'm going into a private building or a corporation building beside this state capitol, because it's a registered corporation building, and when you pass administrative rules, they're copyrighted, so it's a corporation. So it is very disturbing that we go through this frustration with our constitutional rights. And I'm going to read something in the next bill, but I'm going to turn this one into evidence on this one. Attorney license is a fraud. The Supreme Court in the state of Oregon and administration has proven it. So I'm turning in the actual evidence from the Supreme Court and the faxes on attorneys. We know it's a fraud. I'm being threatened with my life in Lincoln County again. Rob Avett behind me used to be a district attorney in Lincoln County. I'm one that went after him when I was I'm going to get into that with the other bill. But I want to make sure this is in record. And then I'll get into the actual Constitution here that Oregon State has to comply with, I mean. So I want to make sure this is in the record. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 173.
I am. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 173 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 173 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any questions? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Olson will be the carrier. Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 391.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 391A comes to us from the Senate Interim Committee. This bill passed unanimously out of the Senate Judiciary and passed 27-3 from the Senate floor. The bill prohibits the seizure of a deposit for security release in a criminal case without first obtaining a search warrant or court order. It requires the court order for transfer or distribution of property after seizure. The bill states that a person designated by the magistrate to accept security in a criminal case acts as the agent of the court for that purpose and requires the court clerk to accept security during normal business hours. And the bill specifies that security may be posted in the form of cash, cashier's check, credit card, or money order. We do have two amendments before the committee today. The proposed A2 amendments give the authorities 48 hours after the seizure to obtain a warrant or a court order, and the proposed A3 amendments specify that the defendant is not released from custody while waiting for authorities to secure that order within 48 hours of seizure.
Okay, and the paperwork's not ready, so we will not be moving the bill today. I will call Gail Meyer, Graham Fisher, and Kimberly McCullough, please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, testifying in favor of the engrossed version of Senate Bill 391 and against the A2 and A3 proposed amendments. The practice that's being addressed here is one that not only interferes with the judicial administration of bail, but also implicates the Fourth Amendment rights of search and seizure, Fifth Amendment rights of not having your property removed without due process of law, and Eighth Amendment rights, which deal with the rights of bail and their corollaries in the Oregon Constitution. It addresses a simple proposition that when the judicial branch establishes a bail amount and someone arrives to the courthouse or to the jail for the purposes of depositing bail to release someone, that law enforcement cannot just unilaterally intercept that transaction and seize the attempted bail without a judicial order, either a search warrant or an order for forfeiture. So in this instance, when the court establishes bail, you're entitled, and we use the word bail here, but we don't really have bail in our statutes. We have security for release, but if I say bail, that's what I mean. When bail is set, you're supposed to be able to make payment of that at the courthouse. Our statutes read that the court clerk can accept the bail or the clerk's designee. The designee is very frequently the jail administrator. And that makes sense because often the courthouse isn't open, so you have to be able to make the payment someplace. And so you go to the jail, and that's convenient often for people because that's when someone is released from where they are released. Our statutes are also clear that the designee shall receive the bail amount, the designee shall give a receipt for the bail, and the designee shall promptly, within a reasonable time, deposit that money with the clerk of the court. So that's what our established laws already state. What's happened in a certain case scenarios is that when someone does come to the jail for the purposes of depositing bail, some cases are internally flagged at the jail for special attention. And if an individual is to arrive and attempt to post bail, instead of conducting that transaction as a designee of the court, they flag the case agents. The case agents come and interrogate the individual who's attempting to post the bail, and often they seize the bail without any warrant or intervention. Make no mistake about it, the difference between the A3, the A2 and A3 amendments and the A engrossed version of the bill is it recognizes the importance of the warrant requirement at the time of seizure. The seizure occurs when they interrupt that ministerial function, if I might use the word, for purposes of transacting the release, when they interfere with that and then ultimately seize the money and don't allow it to be deposited for purposes of release. That is a seizure under the search and seizure clauses. And the question really posed is, what exception, if any, applies such that there should be an exception to the warrant requirement at that time? The only ones that we've heard expressed is an exigency, in that if they don't seize it right away, it'll go deposited with the clerk of the court, it'll be converted to a different use, i.e. for purposes of release, and therefore they have to seize it right away. The challenge to that, though, is the money goes nowhere. It stays on deposit with the clerk of the court. They know exactly where it is. It's in a segregated account. And so the money doesn't dissipate as it would in the field if some money were found in a car. It's on deposit with the clerk of the court. Other than that, I know of no other exception to the search warrant requirement that would apply here. The A3 amendment proposes that there should be a 48-hour exception. They can seize it as long as they get a court order or a warrant within 48 hours. The individual has to remain in jail during that 48-hour period. There is no 48-hour exception to the warrant requirement. This is a seizure. You'll be hearing testimony from Graham Fisher, who is a practitioner in Portland, who had a case in Clackamas County, and I'll let him relate the facts of how this looks actually on the ground. So that's subsection 1 of the bill. Subsection 2 of the bill further states that if there is a seizure, that the law enforcement agencies cannot further distribute, disperse, or share those proceeds without getting yet again a further court order. That is already required by our law. But what does happen is agents will seize the bail money, and then they'll turn around and give it over to the federal government, even though there's an intended state prosecution, and they give it to the federal government under the Federal Equitable Sharing Program. And this is a civil asset forfeiture program that basically has very lax forfeiture rules and often are very much less strict than state forfeiture rules. So under Oregon law, if there were to be an Oregon forfeiture proceeding, they would have to show proof beyond a reasonable doubt of commission of a crime. And the seizing agency would be ultimately downstream of a certain percentage of the proceeds, but in no event more than 50%. If it's sent over to the federal government for the purposes of the Federal Equitable Sharing Program, and the federal government undertakes federal forfeiture, they only have to show things by a preponderance of evidence, and the seizing agency gets 80% of the proceeds of the seized funds. So there's great incentive to further distribute these seized funds over to the federal government. Now, full disclosure here, Eric Holder more recently issued an order limiting the amount of transfer of these civil forfeiture funds to the federal government under the Federal Equitable Sharing Program, but that order is just simply an order, and there are exceptions to it, and we can't say with confidence that that can't still happen. So subsection 2 of the bill would prevent further transfer of these seized funds without, again, judicial oversight. And lastly, Section 3 does state that the clerk of the court shall accept deposits during normal business hours of the court. That would allow an individual to not only avoid this sort of attention and interdiction, but also avoid a certain kiosk system that exists that charges additional fees if you use the kiosk system in the jail lobby. So that's the oversight. A lot here. What you're going to hear from Mr. Fisher is an account of a real story, case in Clackamas County and how it unfolded. And I know that Ms. McCullough from the ACLU is also here, but happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gail, this is a difficult bill to read.
Oh.
Just when I read it, it was not clear to me. Then you've given some testimony, which is actually fairly dense. There's a couple things, and so I'm hoping we can go over a couple things. First of all, and I'm reading between the lines here, but I'm hoping we can maybe distill it and make it a little more clear.
Okay.
Is what is happening in practice that are these drug cases we're talking about?
Chair Barker.
This is drug money that's being alleged to be used, and is that what's happening? Are we talking about drug cases?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, most commonly, I can't say exclusively, most commonly.
And following up, so that's what I suspected, but then within your testimony, I thought I heard two different arguments. And I just want to be clear if that's what you're saying. Number one, I think you essentially said that you contend that this is an unconstitutional practice, i.e. that seizing this without a warrant is unconstitutional. And if that is the case, then why are we making a statutory fix? Are you arguing it's unconstitutional? If so, what are the courts? That's the province of the courts. Number two, you're also perhaps suggesting that certain agencies are doing this basically for profit motive, and particularly shifting it to federal. Is this what you're saying, or are you just being tactful?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton. With respect to the unconstitutionality of the seizure, we do agree it is unconstitutional. What you'll hear when Mr. Fisher relates his story, there is no procedural mechanism to get this bail money back when it's seized. There's a procedural mechanism in our code for the return of things seized, but that applies to evidence and things that's held in custody by the state. But when some third party comes to the counter to deposit bail and that is seized, there's no procedure in our code to remedy that. So just getting before the court on a motion proved to be very difficult for Mr. Fisher to do. So number one, that's why we felt legislation was important, was to set up a prohibition against this conduct, but B, at least some mechanism by which it can be addressed.
So just so I'm clear, thank you for letting me interrupt you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is, although you think it is unconstitutional that there's not an adequate remedy in the statute, you think is necessary to provide some kind of statutory framework to remedy that constitutional violation. Is that what I think you're saying? Do I have that right?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I wouldn't quarrel with your characterization. We're prohibiting
it. I'm trying to understand.
We're prohibiting the seizure without a court order. It can either be a search warrant because this is evidence, or it can be a forfeiture order under state forfeiture law. But it cannot be unilaterally seized during the course of posting bail or attempting to post bail. If they want to seize it in the parking lot, they can do that. And
I need to follow up on that. Okay, yeah. So that you just threw me off by seizing in the parking lot. Explain that to me,
please.
Yeah, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, the jail administrator is acting as the court's designee at the counter. This is where this is all being interdicted. They are essentially asking the jail administrator, this case is specially flagged. Mm-hmm. Call the agent before you accept this and transact this bail transaction. And so then they further detain the individual and interrogate them. If they get probable cause in the field to to go seize this as proceeds, and they want to go seize it, and they want to go put a forfeiture order on it, independent of that transaction, this bill does not address that. This is an interference with the act of receiving or attempting to receive deposits of security for purposes of release. This is an interference with the court's designee in conducting bail transactions.
Okay, so my follow-up. So the way I understand reading the bill, that you're given this 48-hour window period.
That's the A3 amendment.
Right. Right, with that amendment. And it's only in regards to the criminal asset forfeiture portion of the bill that we passed years ago.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, this doesn't really identify whether it be criminal or civil forfeiture. It requires a court order prior to seizure. So it can either be pursuant to a search warrant, or it can be under, maybe that is civil forfeiture, 131A060.
It was my understanding that it was strictly criminal, but maybe.
No, that's civil.
I've been investigating that since we discussed before we got started. You could use a civil forfeiture.
Okay, so that's all right.
Okay.
Okay, so it could go either way. All right, good.
Right. And if I might continue, Vice Chair Olson, this bill is not attempting to suggest that there can't be interdiction of money out in the field at all. What seems to be the case, and for the committee's reference, I've uploaded onto OLIS other news accounts of this conduct occurring in other states. And essentially, the jail is not acting in its capacities as the designee of the court when it's conducting these transactions, but rather is facilitating perhaps further additional law enforcement activity. The point is, at the time of interception of the transaction, that is a seizure. And so where and what exception to the warrant requirement exists? We know of none.
Okay, so let's walk through a scenario here, if you mind.
Please.
So Representative Barton gets arrested for, let's say, a stolen auto, okay, unauthorized use of motor vehicle, and the car is worth $50,000. I'm coming in with posting 10% of that as bail. It's during the weekend. The court does not have anybody available to receive that. Mm-hmm. So as an agent for the courts, the sheriff's office, the jail, would receive that. And you're calling that a seizure?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, no. No, when the person comes to the counter for purposes of posting the bail and the jailer accepts that, they're acting as the court's designee for the purpose of processing the bail. The seizure comes in when what happens in these cases is internally within the jail administration, they've flagged particular cases for special attention. And again, usually drugs, but I cannot tell you exclusively drugs. And the jailer will say, thank you for your money order. Have a seat. They'll call the case agent. They'll wait. Case agent arrives. May I come back here into the interrogation room? I have some questions for you. And they'll interrogate. They'll often bring the canine units around. They'll smell the money. They will or they won't alert. And the question becomes, who are you? How are you related to the defendant? How much money do you make? Do you have a job? Do you have any W-2s to prove you have a job? What are your monthly expenses? On and on and on. The time it takes to wait for the case agent to show up, to interrogate the individual, and then to ultimately seize the cash far exceeds the amount of time it would take to get a search warrant. And that's very apparent when you hear Mr. Fisher tell and relate his story. The individual who attempted to post bail was detained for over 2 hours in the course of the interrogations. So all we're saying is the interception comes from, and what happened in Mr. Fisher's case and what happens in other cases, and again, those case examples are uploaded on OLIS, is law enforcement takes the money. The court never knows that an individual even attempted to post bail. There's no record of any attempt. There's no record of any deposit, nothing. They just take the money. And then what happened in Mr. Fisher's case is they turned around and gave it to the feds. So he couldn't even have, he didn't even have a mechanism to get it back on the state side. There was no procedural mechanism to get a hearing.
Okay, so, okay, just I get what you're wanting to say, bail is bail. And if it's outside of that scope of it, then you have to get a search warrant. That's what you're saying, okay.
Right.
So, Mr. Chairman, Gail, I'm sorry I seem confused, but I'm pretty sure, and I'm going to repeat my question, I'm pretty sure that really the thrust of your argument is that this is an unconstitutional taking, which is a perfectly fine argument. I'm not trying to weigh in the merits of that argument either way. However, that is an argument that is left to the courts. We are not a constitutional court. We are, have you taken that up with the courts? Have the courts weighed in on this? I assume there's some body of law that says you are right in the situation or you're wrong in the situation, and that is precedent that helps guide other courts. Why are we here in the legislature?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, the question is really, what's the mechanism to get before the court and how timely can you do that? Meanwhile, the individual is sitting in jail.
Right.
When the courts have said he can be released upon posting of X amount of money. Okay, so what happens is the accused often doesn't even know, the person in jail often doesn't even really know that somebody attempted, okay,
right.
The courts don't know.
Right.
There's no record. The lawyer appointed to represent or does represent the defendant often doesn't know. I mean, they hear about it, but it would require the third party who came to the window, whose money was seized,
right,
to go suit up, get a lawyer, and go chase it down. Meanwhile, the accused is still in jail. And so we felt the appropriate resolution to this issue is to say at the front end, it's a prohibition. If the government contends that this bail money is proceeds, essentially, of illegal activity, there's no bar from them putting a forfeiture hold on that money. It's on deposit with the clerk of the court. It's not going anywhere. There is no exception to the warrant requirement here.
That's the argument. That's your argument you keep coming back to. No exception. This is unconstitutional.
It's a seizure.
Right.
It's a seizure without lawful order. It's a seizure.
And that there's no, and you're saying you don't have a sufficient remedy, which is why you need the statute. All right, I keep coming back to this,
yeah,
but I just don't feel, there's something I'm missing or there's something you're not answering or both. But I'm struggling. I'm just trying to figure out, have courts weighed in on that? Has anyone ever challenged
Mr. Fisher's case,
right,
and he's here to tell the story.
Yeah, we should, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you, Cam.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for having me here, Chair Barker and Barton. My name is Graham Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, and I'm a lawyer in Portland. So to give a little details about how this played out in my case and then other cases that I've become aware of, this was March of last year in Clackamas County that there was an attempt to post bail with somebody who wasn't my client at the time, but I later represented by family members who came to the jail in Clackamas County. And in Clackamas County, unlike some other counties in Oregon, the jail is the sole administrator of bail, where you have to go to post security. And in Clackamas County, they have decided to require bail only in cash. And so the bail in this case was set at $250,000, so 10% of that, $25,000, needed to be posted to release him. And that was the order of the court. And family members came in, I think there were about four of them, and gave $25,000 to the clerk at the window. And my understanding through speaking with the family and getting later police reports is that they took the money and said, you need to wait. And later I learned through both police reports and contested hearing that we had on the issue is that the clerk at the jail window was not permitted to proceed with the bail-taking transaction. They were directed by law enforcement, if anybody, for this inmate or other inmates that we have flagged, which is a secret flagged list of people that they're not permitted to receive bail for, that if anybody for this person or other flagged inmates comes to the window and tries to bail them out, call case agents. And so that's what they did. And it took about an hour, a little more, for case agents to arrive. And they got to the jail lobby and contacted the family members and brought a drug dog. And first they did a test of the money. And you may know, I know through being a defense lawyer, that there's case law that says 80 to 90% of cash has drug residue on it. So a drug dog alerting to cash, which again they require in Clackamas County, isn't really probative of much. It kind of proves that it is, in fact, cash. This drug dog did not alert to the any residue on the money. And so with that, then they didn't accept the bail and release the person who went on to be my client. What they did was they conducted about another hour and a half of interrogation, questioning each family member individually about how much money do you earn, do you have W-2s, where's the proof that this is lawful. They made phone calls because some of the money was loaned from other family members, calling other family members, pressing them about, you know, how much money do you spend for your cable bill? How much money do you spend on groceries? They're trying to add it up, and they're doing a full interrogation, basically a uniform support affidavit deposition type of investigation while the bail money is sitting behind the counter and the person sitting in jail. And so this proceeded for about another hour, and they decided they weren't satisfied. This was a group of some English-speaking, some Spanish-speaking, and some of the interrogation went on through the assistance of a family member who agreed to interpret for the police officer to help them understand the source of the money. And they decided that they weren't satisfied, that it all added up to them. And what they did was one of the officers on duty wrote the person who tried to post the bail a property receipt that said, we're keeping this money for safekeeping. And that was as opposed to a notice of civil forfeiture, which we later learned was the intention of the law enforcement to forfeit it, though not in state court. They intended to forfeit it through the equitable sharing program in federal court. And so they gave the person a property receipt for safekeeping for this $25,000 and sent him on their way. Later, I became this person's lawyer, and I got it, and I didn't quite know what to make of it. And I called the case agents and said, well, you know, what I would like you to do is either return that money or release the client. And the response was, can't do that. We're beginning the process of federally adopting this money. And there was no way that I could tell to get a hearing because there was no there's no seizure pursuant to an order, a forfeiture order. They didn't start a process through civil forfeiture. And at that time, it just wasn't clear. I talked it around, and it was not clear to me how to lawfully contest this kind of hybrid process where they were starting to federally adopt it but hadn't officially done it because the federal forfeiture adoption gives them a much longer timeline to move and act and give a forfeiture complaint. But it was still sitting in the jail inaccessible. Then some time passed, and then another family member was able to acquire and provided documentation of a lawful source of the bail money. And another attempt was made to post the bail. This was in May of last year. And the same thing happened. The jail clerk called for law enforcement. The drug dog came. This time it did alert on the cash. There was no other evidence of indicating any connection to drug proceeds, aside from, according to the officers, they thought that it was bundled strangely in a way that gave indicia that to them it thought it was drug proceeds. And in that case, the officer who seized the bail in May did give a notice of that it was beginning a civil forfeiture action. I had later done a little more research, and I figured out that that the vehicle to get a hearing on this was a motion to return things seized. And so I filed one, and we eventually had a contested hearing, but not before we had some objections about the timing of it. And you know, every judge that I talked to that I was before on this issue in Clackamas County was shocked and astonished, indicated that one judge, Judge Steele, said it was hinky what was going on at the jail. The presiding judge, Herndon, said it was stunningly incorrect in his view. But at the hearing, we learned that this process was routine, relatively routine in Clackamas County, because these case agents said that they had assisted on a number of seizures, which they did basically the same thing. They would give property receipts, take the money, and so this bail money would vanish from the courts and not be challenged in any meaningful way. Ultimately, we had a hearing some 60 days after the initial attempt to post bail, not before, though, the jail had released on the morning of one hearing that we were supposed to have the money to the federal government in an attempt to keep us from having a hearing. So you asked Representative Barton, why do we need this bill? And my sense as a practitioner is because without something that makes the law more clear, jails, at least in my case and in other cases that I later became aware of, were doing whatever they could to deprive a person the right to have a hearing about the lawfulness of a seizure, of a bail money seizure.
So you're saying that they transferred it the day before the hearing? Can you clarify that?
Yeah, let me clarify from that, because this is a lot, and this, as you said, is a dense bill, and it's a complex subject. But I had filed a motion to return things seized under ORS Chapter 133.633. And we had a hearing set for Monday afternoon. It was May 12th, if I recall correctly, last May. And the hearing was in the afternoon. Both sets of bail money had been sitting in the jail at that point for, the first bail for over about 60 days. And the bail was removed. The jail gave the bail to federal agents hours before the hearing. And then the county appeared and took the position that the court didn't have their jurisdiction to rule on the lawfulness of the seizures, because the bail, even though it had been sitting in the jail for 60 days prior to the hearing, they didn't have it anymore. The federal agents had it. And the court agreed at that time and said, I agree. I can't order the federal government to order this money returned. That's a different jurisdiction. But I'm troubled by the fact that you appear to be depriving me of my jurisdiction to rule on the lawfulness, the legality of the seizures, which were depriving my client of his constitutional right to bail. And so we sat over the hearing for a few days. And during that time, the second bail money was returned. They were holding on to the first bail money. And then we had a hearing on that on May 16th. And I'm happy to submit, it was before Judge Norby, her factual findings and conclusions. And as Gail pointed out, Judge Norby, and it is in my view, the law, but it's not, it was not the county's view, and it's apparently not the district attorney's view either, that it's okay for you know, in our view, in Judge Norby's order, she said that it is not lawful for there to be a secret list of flagged people that the court doesn't know about, so that when we set bail at a certain amount, the law enforcement says you can't accept it. What you have to do is initiate an investigation, because it's a judicial agent, the person designated by the judiciary that's initiating that investigation. And so that was the initial unlawfulness, but it's an unlawfulness that we really need the judiciary's help, or the legislature's help, to correct, at least as I perceive it, because it was nearly, it took a ton of time to make my client have his constitutional right to bail in his case. That's not what I was brought on the case to do. I was supposed to represent him on the criminal case, but I spent all this time trying to vindicate his right to bail, which was repeatedly interfered with. I later learned that this has been happening throughout the state. I've talked with seven other lawyers, one that had a case that started in Clackamas County, a few that came from Multnomah County, one from Washington, one from Curry County, one from Mallard County. That this appears to be a practice that that goes on routinely, but that lawyers thus far have not been successful in even bringing a challenge to the legality of this seizure. So that is why I think we need your help, is to make a law that says, that shows it's clear that you can't make that initial seizure without a court order.
My name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon, and Gail already laid a lot out for you, and you already heard some examples, so I'm just going to keep my comments somewhat short. I did submit written testimony. It does explain a number of reasons why we agree that this is unconstitutional and also violates certain statutory provisions. But I would like to suggest that there are times when it is proper for the legislature to codify constitutional principles that actually is fairly common. And it particularly happens when a constitutional principle is being violated repeatedly and when the remedy is difficult to attain. And this is one of those cases. I mean, in this situation, essentially the fact that a person is associated with someone who has been arrested is being used as a basis to suspect that person who's associating with them. I'm not going to say that there aren't situations when that person who is associated with the person who's been arrested may also be a criminal, and there may be some basis for seizing money that they have. All this would require is court oversight of that. Essentially, what's happening is we have this fact of association and the fact that someone has been arrested and that bail has been posted being sort of promoted as an exception to the warrant requirement, and that's very improper. A couple of things. Just we do think that it's unconstitutional for a number of reasons, and one is that individuals do have a constitutional right to be released when bail has been posted. The other is that we do think that as a constitutional matter, these folks that are at the police department who are taking the money are acting as fiduciaries of the court. Just a couple of things about, even though that these are constitutional rights that we have, we also do already have some, we've had some need for statutory action on this issue. ORS 131A.035 was adopted in 1993. That prohibits the seizure of currency less than $15,000 on the basis that it's cash as opposed to something else. And certainly just the simple basis, you know, the fact that it was cash is not necessarily a reason to think that that is you know, you may suspect it, but it's not enough reason to seize it. And yet that was happening over and over again. And so this legislature passed that law in 1993. And the Oregon voters had to pass a law in 2000, which was amended in 2008, related to seizures that were being turned over to the federal government, and prohibiting that without probable cause. You know, even though we have actually had to do things in the past and the voters have had to do things in the past, there's still a problem. The problem is still happening. It's very difficult to remedy. It's not just the seizure that's the violation. It's the fact that the person is sitting in jail. And that you can't remedy that, right? Like, that happened and that's happening. And you know, maybe you can remedy it down the road where they then get out of jail. But all of that time when they had a constitutional right to be out, they weren't. So I would like to suggest that this is something that we should address. Thank you.
Any questions?
So, yeah, I want to follow up. Okay, so Graham, I find it interesting how you're describing what happened up there for you in Clackamas County. Let's go back to Clackamas County, and I'm coming to bail out my best friend, you know, who I don't know what he's doing, driving a stolen car. But anyways, I bring in a shopping bag full of cash, since that's all Clackamas County ever receives, from what I understand. It just so happens, to my luck, that a deputy has a dope-sniffing dog and hits on the bag of money. So now all of a sudden, and I understand that too, that about 90% of the cash right in the currency right now in America has got, my understanding, cocaine on it. So you're going to seize the cash. He doesn't get out. Why would you not at that point then move forward with an asset forfeiture rather than just seize it and provide a receipt for that? I'm just trying to walk through this here a little bit.
Well,
because I mean, where you're wanting to go, I understand this, but I'm trying to get through with what I recall too for forfeiture.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, what our bill would say is that the jail clerk at the window would then have to start a warrant or a court order application to seize that. And based on the facts you're giving, I mean, it would be up to a judge whether that would be enough evidence, just that is in a shopping cart, and it would be in how the warrant affidavit was framed. But I think that would be if they want to seize it before it's applied to bail and your friend is released, that would be the lawful way to do it. They could refuse to take it. That's another option that the jail has if they, what they don't want to make the warrant affidavit, but they think that it's suspicious and they don't want to let the person out. They can say no thanks, come back another time and confer and, you know, conduct a money laundering investigation or something into what you have in the shopping cart. You know, we're just saying that it's unlawful and offends the Constitution if they decide they take the money and keep the person in jail.
Okay.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, as you were saying, Vice Chair Olson, walk me through this. Mm-hmm. What our bill would say is this. They come to the jail administrator's desk. They act as the designee of the court. They say thank you very much. They count it out. They give them a receipt, and they process the bail. The government, however, contends that this is proceeds. The government can go get a forfeiture order and put it on file. You know, they can attach the account in the court accounts. They can put the forfeiture order on the court account. They can either ask for an immediate hearing for purposes of forfeiture. We think this is proceeds. You ought to pull this guy back into custody. And, you know, or they can say, we'll resolve this later or before bail is returned at the end of the case. We want to be heard. We think this is proceeds. It doesn't mean that the government would have a remedy. It's just that they couldn't seize it without judicial order. And I just want to get back to the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment says they can seize it, hold the inmate in custody for 48 hours, if they don't get any warrant or forfeiture order within 48 hours, then they have to deposit the money with the clerk of the court, and the defendant gets to be released. The problems with that are a couple-fold. Number one, there is no 48-hour exception to the warrant requirement. That is number one. There isn't one. Number two, where's the oversight and check and balance on this? The courthouse, the courts, still don't know the seizures occurred. So who's minding the shop to make sure that this 48-hour limitation is being abided by? So.
May I ask some questions? Thank you. First of all, would you be so kind as to circulate Judge Norby's findings of fact?
Yep.
I would appreciate that. Any other documents that you don't have to do it now, it can be, but if you have it handy, thank you. Gail, what was I going to ask? Let's pretend, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, the kind of the point of the security interest, the bail, is to that's the leverage to prevent, for example, flight, for example. To the extent, if the government then attempts to, after releasing the person, immediately afterwards initiates forfeiture such that they're not going to get that money anyway, doesn't that kind of defeat the theory and purpose of bail?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, it might, but we think that's something for the court to consider, and the court can consider it when they set the amount of bail. And the court can be involved with all of this. If you would contend that government, you're going to be seizing this bail at the end of the adjudication, at the end of the case, then the court can consider all that. This plays out in federal court a lot often. Sometimes that, you know, if someone comes to deposit bail in federal court, and then they attach the bail, and then you have a hearing. So, I mean, they'll do that on attorney's fees. They'll contend that the attorney's fees is proceeds, and then you have to have a hearing on that. Yeah. But the point of it is there's judicial oversight. Mm-hmm. And in Mr. Fisher's case, there was no judicial oversight. And what we're attempting to institute here is judicial oversight. You may not seize it absent either a search warrant or a forfeiture order.
And a follow-up question, perhaps of counsel or of anyone, where do the A3 amendments come from? Who's introducing them? Because I'm looking out. Are they?
Mr. Bovet.
Ah. I didn't realize he was coming to testify. Yeah. Okay, good.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Williamson.
Counsel and I have been sitting back here chatting, and so I want Jeff to ask his questions on the record, if that's okay with you.
It is okay with
you. All right, there you go.
And I hate to spring these on you.
Okay.
So if a court were to predetermine that a warrant should be issued for security, would that count as a predetermination that then PC exists for forfeiting that property later on? Because that's the standard that the court's using to see if whether it's going to be subject to forfeiture in the first instance. So now we have a court within 48 hours making that determination. Does that then mean that the property is automatically subject to forfeiture?
Chair Barker, Counsel Rhodes, I think that the final forfeiture order is dependent on beyond reasonable doubt. So there's the initial seizure, and then there's your ultimate forfeiture order.
So I'm looking at 131A100.
Hearing on probable cause and decision of seeking forfeiture, but that's different from...
So then would that, I guess my question is the warrant then going to be used as evidence for why that property should be forfeited?
You're talking about the search warrant?
Yes.
Oh, Chair Barker, Counsel Rhodes, as I understand the search warrant, you're allowed to seize that for purposes of evidence. That's evidence. So sometimes the money is evidence, right? I mean, and so under subsection A, the search warrant would be issued pursuant to 133.545. That's for purposes of evidence. And then, or alternatively, for forfeiture under 131A060. And so, so the initial seizure for forfeiture is ordered on probable cause. That's your question. So if you get a search warrant under probable cause, is that sufficient to constitute an order for probable cause seizure? I would submit that the standard is probably the same.
And And then the other...
The difference between the two is what's the purpose of seizing the funds? Is it because it's going to be used later as evidence for purposes of proving a crime occurred, or is it simply to forfeit the funds irrespective of the criminal action?
And the other question I had has to do with, if you have it in front of you, or we could talk online offline about it, 131A050 sub 2, which allows that property may be unconstitutionally seized and forfeited just based so long as the seizure is not, the forfeiture is not based on the fruit of unconstitutional seizure. So it seems to suggest that you can still forfeit property that is the subject of an unconstitutional seizure.
Chair Barker, Council Rhodes, could you give me that reference again, 131 what?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just springing this on you right now, Gail. 131A050.
Subsection?
2.
Yes, property that has been unconstitutionally seized may be forfeited if the property is determined to be subject to forfeiture under this chapter based on evidence that is not the fruit of the unconstitutional seizure. Right. What it does say is that 131A060 says seizure without a court order. Property may be seized for forfeiture by a police officer without a court order if, A, there is probable cause to believe that property is subject to forfeiture and the property may constitutionally be seized without a warrant. And that's where I get back to the point of what's the exception to the warrant requirement when you're at the jail clerk desk? There is none. There is no exigency. You know where that cash is going, and every dollar of it is going to be there when you get your court order. There's no exception to the warrant requirement at the jail counter desk. And the -A3 amendment sets up a 48-hour exception to the warrant requirement when you're at the jail administrator's desk.
Thank you very much, Ben. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Bovet, please.
Thank you.
I definitely would like to converse with Rob Bovet on some of this because you personally have had involvement with this.
We're just having testimony today, so.
Yeah, I understand. It is testimony. But we've had personal involvement on this in the county. One of the reasons why he resigned.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties, actually here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Ms. Vittelins wishes she could be here, but she's in Crook County doing her day job and asked me to cover this. I was just going to spend a few minutes with you explaining the -A3s, but I've heard so much information here that I guess I just disagree with. I was served as a forfeiture counsel for 16-plus years, helped craft a lot of these statutes that we've been talking about with, actually, Mr. Fedanke. And so I have a different take on a lot of this stuff. In terms of bail seizures, I get the issue we've heard about here today, where you can have a seizure and then someone's waiting in jail and nobody's making a determination, no judicial oversight. Now, I will say that if there is a bail seizure under Oregon's forfeiture law and notice is served as it's required to be served promptly. Counsel's already pointed out ORS 131A100, which is a statute we crafted in the 90s that would provide for prompt post-seizure due process probable cause hearing because the Ninth Circuit has told us that's required. In terms of what exception to the search warrant requirement would apply in a bail seizure context, it is in fact exigent circumstances, and there's case law on this point. But I get the issue that they're trying to address. And so the -A3s, the impracticality of the bill as it is written right now is that bail seizures and investigations are often fast-moving and rolling very quickly. And there is, in many cases, no way to get a seizure order or a search warrant timely enough in advance. So the idea of the A3 is to put a limit on how much time can linger before we get a judicial determination of probable cause. And so the A3s basically say, yes, you can't just seize the bail money like you've been doing, and I believe it's constitutional, by the way, because we have a statute, and it was already pointed out by counsel, actually by Ms. Myers as well, that says And we crafted it this way. You don't have to get a search warrant if it's seized pursuant to there's probable cause to believe the property is subject to forfeiture and the property may constitutionally be seized without a warrant. So that's the hitch. So we think that the A3s are a fair compromise to ensure that people aren't effectively laundering proceeds of crime through bail and just getting people out, letting the bail money get forfeited to the court system, not where it should be forfeited to, and essentially circumventing the system, but also putting a check on it to say, hey, if you're going to seize this because you've got exigent circumstances and you couldn't get a search warrant or court order in advance, then you got to get one within 48 hours and go to the court after the fact. So that's what I was going to pitch to you here today. We think this is the A3s would make this bill a good bill and put the appropriate checks and balances in place. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Thanks,
Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Bovet, you said that the applicable exception to the warrant requirement is exigent circumstances and that there is case law on point. Can you tell us more about that, please? Why is it, and what can you do? Not that you knew to bone up on this case law beforehand, but to the extent you can tell us or get back to us,
sure.
I appreciate it.
Chair Barker and Representative Barton, so I am not good with case names, and it's been 7 years since I've practiced forfeiture law. But there is this huge volume of case law about forfeiture, and it's a little odd in the sense that we're talking about areas that lie between civil and criminal law. So various aspects of things bleed out into this law from various places. But the Ninth Circuit has been much more restrictive than other areas in terms of prompt post-seizure due process hearing that have to be fairly expedited. There's a case out of San Francisco to that point. In terms of exigency, again, I don't remember the specific case laws, but I would describe it in plain English this way. If you are faced with a situation where someone's presenting a bag of cash that you have suspicion and developing probable cause is, in fact, proceeds of a crime, you don't have a judge sitting right here. Now, telephonically, we can get them pretty quick, but it's too late. So essentially, you have to make the seizure right now. I would equate it to a Brown stop type situation. You've got a vehicle that can roll down the road. And in this case, you've got money that can literally roll down the road and be deposited into the court right there. So if you don't like the 48-hour thing, if there's a way to put in statute, but I like this less because I think this might have constitutional problems, some sort of temporary hold while we get a warrant, I think that's potentially much more problematic legally, but I haven't fully thought it through. But what right now what's happening is, and I understand it, if they're not doing a state forfeiture action, then 131A100 is not triggered. So it's just being seized as evidence. And then, as counsel described, you're stuck really with just doing a motion for return of things seized. So I get that. If it's in this limbo land and it's just seized as evidence, not being applied to bail, there needs to be a check on that. And so the district attorneys decided, well, let's just make the police get a seizure order or a warrant within 48 hours. And if not, let the bail money flow.
Representative Krieger.
I'm trying to follow this, Rob. It's the source of the money, then, that allows for the forfeiture?
Yes.
So I, as a grandparent, go grab $25,000 out of the bank that I've been putting in there $5 at a time for all these years, go down to bail out my grandson. I don't know whose testimony. I don't know if it's got the dog could sniff it. And they could take that money and not apply it to the release?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, on the facts that you gave me, no. Because
they could just make the accusation, yep, that's what it is, and it's done, it's passed the clerk, and it's given to the feds, and it's gone.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, under ORS 131060, they have to have probable cause to believe it's subject to forfeiture, in this case, i.e., the proceeds of crime. and they have to have an identifiable exception to the search warrant requirement. So if they did as you described, they would be violating the statutes.
And who would prosecute them for that?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, very valid question, but I think that's a question of accountability with law enforcement rather than a question of making the statutes work with the appropriate checks and balances.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
The agent that's receiving the money is the agent of the court. What other authority does that agent have to receive any money? In other words, if he wasn't acting as the agent of the court, he couldn't even receive the money.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I'm not exactly sure I understand
your question. Well, it seems like
question.
The only way or the reason that he can receive it is acting as an agent of the court for the purpose of the authority that the court vests in him to receive it for bail.
And not an agent of law enforcement. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
That person's the agent of the court at that point, not an agent of law enforcement. And so if they take the money in as an agent of the court, then they don't have the authority as a law enforcement agent to take that money. Is that what you're saying?
You're taking it from one hand and giving it to the other. I'm not certain that you have authority to give it over to the federal agent, even if it is fruits of a crime, until the court tells you you can. I'll tell you, if I was a judge and someone did it, there'd be the agent probably being held in contempt of court and be going to jail.
And Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I'm not even sure how to answer that question, and I'm not sure how to answer what happened in Clackamas County, because these are all new facts to me. So I'm not sure how the federal system works. We put pretty tight limitations on the transfer of cases from the state system to the federal system, you may recall. So I just don't know enough about the operative facts here. You know, like I say, I was intending to spend 2 minutes describing the A3s and why we think they're a better fit, but here we are.
Thank you for, I was trying to clarify it in my own head, Representative Krieger, what you were saying. So sorry for me to just blurt that out.
Two of us get it cleared up, didn't we?
Yeah, I think so. So Rob, you said that if the money was given to the agent and used as bail, that it would be forfeited to the court system and not forfeited to the place it should go. What did you mean by that? Did you mean that it should be going to law enforcement as evidence, or I'm interested in that.
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I was probably very inarticulate. What I meant to say is that, let's see if I can describe it this way. So let's just assume for the sake of argument that we're talking about a pile of drug money.
Right.
And it shouldn't be used to bail anybody out. It should, because that's essentially they're just forfeiting it. Mm-hmm. The drug organization is just getting their person out and forfeiting the money. They're not going to appear. They're just gone, right? So that money has essentially bailed someone out and has not been forfeited as drug proceeds and prevented them from using those forfeiture, which should be forfeited, as a mechanism to get someone out of custody. So the problem is what it's being used as. It's just being used as drug money to get a drug dealer out of custody.
And so the issue is that the person's out of custody and they flee.
Right.
Like they're a flight risk. And the organization knows that it's the money is drug proceeds, and so they're not going to – it's going to go somewhere either way. And so there's no – they don't care enough about the money for the guy to actually appear.
Chair Barker, Representative, that's kind of what I was implying.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're getting the both the benefit.
And is that the exigent circumstances then that get you around the warrant requirement?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, yes, in the sense that if law enforcement is fast moving on a big drug case, because we're talking about drug cases primarily, not all always, then often they're going from one place to the next, and they're sometimes chasing folks around. And if someone is going to the jail, they pulled up to the parking lot, they've got $500,000 in a paper baggie, whatever it was, in the parking lot, and we're saying that law enforcement can't even seize that money until they have a search warrant or court order, and this person's walking into the jail, there's no way to get that document between the 5 minutes that I'm watching this occur. That makes sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Okay.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you. Johnson, come here.
I don't know how to solve it. Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnston. That's my given name. I'm an American. I'm not a British subject. And I have filed in this building on it as well. What's disturbed me, this is another rape, rob, and pillaging bill to the public. I'm dealing with this personally right now in Lincoln County, where a numerous attempts on my life, and Rob Yvette personally knows it. Knows the cases where I've been kidnapped for deregulating my car and speaking out. And the last time they tried to kill me in Lincoln County when I was having a heart attack in the jail when I came out of the hospital here to testify on another bill where the attorneys were trying to steal land from the general public.
So we'd like to talk about
I'm going to be getting, this is all part of the bill. It's all part of the same structure. I have factual evidence to turn in dealing with Eric Holder and the Pope. When the Pope came out and said that the Pope is not, this has everything to do with it, I'm turning in the evidence.
Anybody have any questions?
This is the Piracy Act bill.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3.
Are you saying that the public has no right to testify?
We are adjourned. Thank you, committee.
This goes in.